美国 AI 研究员是怎么看中国 AI 模型发展的？2026年4月，一位在美国 AI 圈极具影响力的研究者专程来到中国，走进北京、杭州和上海的 AI 实验室。他密集拜访了阿里巴巴、预制暗面、智谱、清华、美团、小米、蚂蚁和零一万物等等团队。回到美国之后，他写了一篇文章，在美国科技界是引发了不小的讨论。那这位美国 AI 研究者就是 Nathan Lambert。他的观察也非常有意思。
Who has the best China open source model?
If you put a gun to my head, I would say in as of today.
The biggest disadvantage that the Chinese labs still face today.
Yeah, it's compute. Meta or OpenAI have more GPUs than all of these like Chinese companies combined.
So how good are domestic accelerators such as Huawei chips?
All of those companies are like, if you can give me Huawei chips, we will like, maybe get more customers.
Anthropic CEO Daryl Amodei.
He's a little too aggressive in the near term about risks posed by open weight models.
How many months do you think US SOTA models are ahead of the Chinese models, and for that gap, is it going to become narrower or wider?
在美国 AI 界 ，Nathan 是一个很难绕开的名字。他参与组建了 Hugging Face 的 RLHF 研究团队，后来担任艾伦人工智能研究院 AI2 的大模型后训练负责人，参与打造了 OMO 和 Tulu 等开源模型。同时 ，Nathan 也是 Lex Fridman 播客里的熟面孔。2025年 DeepSeek 引爆全球讨论之后 ，Lex 邀请了 Nathan 和 Semi Analysis 的创始人 Dylan Patel 进行了一场超过5个小时的深度对谈。2026年 ，Nathan 再次登上 Lex 的节目，用4个多小时。盘点全球 AI 的最新进展。Lex 称他是 AI 社区中广受尊敬的研究者、工程师和技术传播者之一，也对全球开源模型有着紧密的追踪。一个长期站在美国开源模型最前线的人，真正走进中国 AI 实验室之后看到了什么？中国和美国的大模型研究分别在发生什么样的变化？这一期硅谷101视频播客，我们飞到了西雅图，与 Nathan Lambert 聊了聊他的中国行，一路上的所见所闻，他眼中的中美 AI 发展意图以及全球大模型竞赛的下一站。同时呢，不要忘记关注硅谷101，不要错过 AI 最前沿的一线内容哦。那以下就是我跟 Nathan 的专访，用全英文进行。
Hello, Nathan. Welcome to Valley 101.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You just came back from a trip to China, during which you actually visited many of China's leading AI labs. Tell us more about that trip.
People always ask me now that I've been back, it's like, what are your big takeaways? And I feel like AI is fairly well known and who is building models and things, so there's not that many things that are like super shocking. You're like, oh, I have this hot take. The trip for me as somebody who covers these models, it's to get to know the people who are doing it and get to pick up on the nuance of why are they doing this.
Yeah.
I think I'm personally just learning a lot about China this year, and there's a lot of people in the US that'll just like say why they might be doing this, and just to get the first person accounting of we're here, we're doing this for these reasons is very nice. I expect to keep covering open models in the future and trying these models.Is an interesting ecosystem that's set up that there's a lot of interest in the US and companies that are building around real open model intelligence stack, which is serving value for all sorts of people. And then a lot of the models are getting built in China. Mm-hmm. And these historic tech communities like, have not intermingled a lot in how they work. So there's traditional policies at places like Meta and Google, where if you travel to China, your laptop automatically breaks itself. And there's like been a wall where people can't easily work together, but they're becoming integrated. And I'm just very interested in it. I think it's surprising in some ways that these models are so competitive. But then when you learn more about all the talent there and things, it's like it becomes somewhat normalized. And I personally, like a lot of the reason that I'm motivated by AI is that I would think that in the next couple of years, it's like a lot of risks, particularly like just social risks and how people are informed. And then also,geopolitically, it's obviously a topic of interest. So just building bridges across people and humanizing the people that are actually doing this because they don't make a lot of the decisions that are listed as political or extreme in any way. And just like building these connections is really useful because it is one community that is kind of moving forward towards these various goals, whether you call it AGI or whatever you want to say the goal is. So I'm just like very happy to meet the humans behind this.
Yeah, great. And how many days did you go? And which cities?
Yeah, so I think it was about 6 or 7 nights, and it was primarily in Beijing and Hangzhou. So it was like 3 or 4 nights in Beijing, which we were staying right near the Olympic Center. So I like go for a jog in this, the Bird's Nest Stadium and all these things. It's just like where you find a hotel. But then most of the companies are by Tsinghua University, and there's this whole cluster of AI startups there, which is really interesting. It feels a lot like the Bay Area, where you're like, oh, I can just walk between all the leading AI companies of the region. And, like, you don't have to do anything. It's like a very Bay Area feeling. And then we also went to Hangzhou for a few nights, which is where Alibaba is and I think DeepSeek is. We didn't go to the DeepSeek office, but we talked to some people, and we did visit Alibaba. And it's just great. It's my first time in China, and nice to see them.
So which labs or companies did you visit this time?
Yeah, I'll try to list many of them. We visited also a bunch of robotics companies, which I didn't focus on as much as writing. But for language models, we visited, well, I went to two different Alibaba offices. I got off the plane in Beijing and immediately went to meet some Quen people in their Beijing office. So there's Alibaba, Kimi, which is Moonshot as well, ZAI, and then Florian, who writes Interconnects with me. We went to Meituan, which has their language modeling effort. And then we also visited Tsinghua University, and we visited the Xiaomi campus in Beijing. And then when we went to Hangzhou, we visited the Alibaba campus there, the Antling team, and also ModelScope, which is also affiliated with Alibaba. And then this was a group trip, a part of mostly organized around this, like, sale, which is a bunch of Substackers that write about AI, which is, like, my friends making a vehicle to do interesting things in AI media and events. So it was mostly organized around this, and then the rest of the group in Shanghai talked to, I think, definitely Minimax and maybe StepFund as well. So there's really a lot of the names. I think there's obvious missions, like DeepSeek is the most secretive one, and ByteDance is also, like, you visit them, and they're, like, all the companies talk about DeepSeek as their, like, kind of mysterious leader, and then ByteDance is like, oh, the one closed AI lab that has a ton of resources that everybody's like worried about the Doubao chatbot is the dominant thing. You pick up on these things pretty quickly when you're there because everybody talks about it.
So in your Substack article, you said you returned with humility. What does it mean?
Yeah, so I feel like as an American scientist, I never really expected to have anything to say about the Chinese tech ecosystem or US-China interactions on a global level. I described it as, like, I knew I didn't know a lot, and I left, and I was like, I still have so much to see. It's like, I saw these two cities in China, and I was on, like, a busy work trip and feeling like you get teleported around in a van. We went to some great dinners, and we saw some cute neighborhoods in Beijing and some of the older buildings and stuff, but it's like, I feel like I don't know so much about China, and to, like, truly have immediate instincts and intuitions about something, you kind of need some more closer to full stack knowledge and appreciation for, like, what would a person's instinct here be? Like, what would a Chinese researcher's instinct be? And it's like, it would take a lifetime for me to fully understand that as an American, as things like, how is the education system different? We went to, like, Tsinghua, and they would talk about, like, we want to, they would acknowledge the reputation where it's like Chinese researchers haven't been as good at this, like, 0-to-1 style science, which is kind of an arbitrary term. It's like, what does that actually mean? Mm-hmm. But they would bring it up. And part of this is in, like, how people are trained and how the talent gets funneled through different layers from a much broader domestic network than in the US. It's like, these are things that people would talk about, and actually seeing them is useful. This year I've read Breakneck and Apple in China, as these two wonderful books on the US tech ecosystem's interactions with China. But that's still, like, a very limited view. So that's why I'm like, okay, I kind of expected this when I left, that I would be like, I don't really understand everything I left, but I still feel like I have more to learn.
Were you meeting with the C-level, C-suite people, or the middle-level AI researcher or engineer-level people? Do you think those conversations are actually helpful?
Yeah, so we were targeting meeting with more researchers just to get a dialogue. We also targeted trying to get leadership, especially at startups. So it seems like mostly talking to researchers. We talked to some executives, say, like Alibaba, or some of these people that we talked to are very well known within companies and interface directly with the founders. But I think that when you're going to do, like, a formal visit, it's a lot of showing respect to the people that are there. But at the end of the day, like, the leaders are more media trained and sometimes will tell you less, and that kind of suppresses nuance to stay on the company line.
Yeah.
So I think it was some of both. The bigger companies, I think, were more, like, open to show some of their senior cloud people without giving too much away. I think some of the conversations were off the record. I don't know. It's not the best answer, but it's a mix.
Yeah, especially with the comms people around.
Yeah, right? Like, most of these have comms handlers in the room. Like, some of the best conversations were, I announce that I'm here, I'm on WeChat, I message people, and then you, like, go get Bobo with a random researcher not on the corporate office, and you're just like, you're like, oh, what are you working on? Like, what are you doing? And then it's like, okay, there's not the veneer of, like, I'm at the office, my manager is sitting next to me, the comms people are sitting next to me. So those are always more fun, but more rare on the trip.
Yeah, definitely. So what kind of questions did you mostly ask them?
There's a distribution, so I think that I was interested in to start with something that's probably pretty accessible to them, which is like, why are you releasing these models? Like, why do you build your model? Why don't you just use DeepSeek's model?
Right.
A lot of these companies are very practical, and it's like, we need AI to serve our users, and we want to own the full stack, and therefore we're going to build it. And they're much more daunted about building AI models being this like super expensive, impossible thing, where there's kind of an allure in the US of like being a frontier lab. It's like restricted to an elite few, but it's like all the companies. That's why it was like we wanted to go visit Meituan. It's one of our favorite like random Chinese tech companies to have big models. So we're like, just go see what they're doing. They're like, yeah, we need this to serve our agentic product. So we build the model. We need it for products. It doesn't matter if it's open. We'll release it as well and get some feedback. And they're very practical about this open science sort of idea. And this would lead into different things like, what are your current bottlenecks, which can obviously quickly be a dead end on compute. But a lot of them are like, Huawei chips are good for inference. We use Huawei for inference, but not really for training. So like a lot of people would say things like this. Also in our group, people would want to talk about like, what is the coming future of AI? So like, what do you view on how it's going to impact labor markets and economics? And like, do you feel like you have a responsibility as a scientist to understand, like think about these impacts? And that's where we saw in China that researchers are much less inclined to share a lot of views on this. Some of this is the corporate environment, but also I think it's just like the environment that's much more structured and what they're encouraged to talk about in their education, which is like, I build the thing, and there's much less of this like podcast ecosystem in China where there's researchers that are like rewarded for being visible and trying to sway the direction of the company. It's like a bit more practical minded, which I think sometimes in my writing got overlapped with the humility, whereas like you can be a humble person, but also you could be in an environment where you're just not used to being asked certain questions.
Cool. Let's talk about some of the companies you visited. In your opinion, how different were they from one another? Let's talk about Moonshot first, shall we?
Yeah, so I think they do have pretty distinct feelings when you could go into them. I think Kimi was one where it's like, these people seem so close and they're just in it for kind of the thrill of building a cool thing, and they're building a business alongside building this cool thing, but they're also just like, we're going to build these models, we use them ourselves, and they seem very close in a way that's like you just pick up intuitively when you like go to the office. You're like, okay, these people are really bonded and they're tight and they're just like spend their lives together building this. I describe Kimi as like the best vibes company of the one that we visited, which is just like they seem like they're happy and they're going on their path, and it's not very corporate in a way where if you go to obviously Alibaba, it's like this is a huge tech company. It's very corporate. The Ant Group, Ant Ling team has some of that because they're also a huge tech company. But even in some of the middle, it's like ZAI was very AGI forwards and they were like had a lot of pride, but at least in the interactions we had, it wasn't as much of this like charm that Kimi and Moonshot have. And some of this might just be like random day to day, like I met these people for a few hours over lunch. You can't conclude a company's trajectory based off this, but it's also interesting because like people are expressive and you can learn things from that.
There was a paper from Moonshot named Attention Residuals, with one of its authors being a 17-year-old high school student. You know about that one. I think that paper was reposted by Elon Musk on X, saying impressive work from Kimi. So this high school student got very famous in China now. So what does that tell you about the culture at Moonshot?
It's like less of a Moonshot-specific thing, but the talent there is very young. These companies are all on a push to have more of a Western media footprint, and there a lot of these researchers are on X. And it's like I knew a few of the people. I think that it's like people that do a mix of product and comms at the company. One is like Crystal, I think, at Kimi, and then Lou at ZAI. And it's like I met Lou, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name exactly right, but she's like 20 and she's still a student. She's like, hey. I'm like, wow. It's like these people are so young. And then one of the Xiaomi researchers we met, Lai Li, he's like also a PhD student and like one of the lead researchers at Xiaomi. There are some people like this in the US which are just extremely motivated to end up at a frontier lab, but it just seems like we're getting so many. When you meet one after another in China, these super young researchers deeply embedded in this labs, it felt like a bit of a structural, just like they absorb this talent much more quickly than other labs and are more open about it. it's wild. I mean, like, I'm in my early 30s. I'm like, these people are so young. It's like, I feel young in my life. And it's like, it's cool to see.
But is it different here in the U.S.?
I think so. Yeah. I think
you
it
don't
is
see
younger
that, like, and, young talents here in U.S. labs.
Yeah, so something that defines AI2 a bit, it's like secret sauce, is that, like, UW is behind you, and we have a lot of PhD students that have been, like, core to Ulmo and core to other major projects who are concurrent students. But that sort of open door is at least, like, less fluid at some of the other labs. Like, I know a handful of PhD students that work at labs, but these are, like, the absolute best of the best in the U.S., where in China it feels like the intermingling of academia, especially at a place like Tsinghua, and these startups nearby, is much more intentional and much higher overlap for the talent.
Why does that matter?
Students are young, they're hungry, they've had nothing else going on. They have much less going on in their life. Like, I'm getting married this year, thinking about family, like, I'm 30, I have all these things. But students are like, this is the technology of my life, I'm just gonna work all the time and absorb all the context. And when you build a language model, like, I work in post-training, you need to know what the pre-training team is doing, you need to know the multiple stages of your recipe, and then you need to figure out, like, what is the bottleneck and go address it. So there's just a really big fixed context of technical knowledge that you need. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just, like, if it's the biggest thing in your life and you don't have a lot of distractions, it's just easier to put all of this into your brain. One of the researchers told us, like, oh, yes, new students don't have priors for what used to work in deep learning. They're not looking at a different architecture or anything. They're just like, I want to know what the current state of the art is and make it better. And it's kind of like a simple approach that they can do. Some of the researchers in China told us this. They're like, yeah, that's what we're doing.
I see. Let's talk about Zhipu. How was the trip there?
It was fun. I think so part of the thing that I learned is that Chinese companies have, like, a showroom culture where when you have visitors, you, like, show the history of your company. Yeah. And Zhipu's showroom is all, like, every panel has some different, like, AGI feature. So it's like AGI loading, or it's like their thing is that AGI, we're like 42% of the way here, which is from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy reference. And you just, like, immediately notice it. You're like, whoa. But at the other time, they're like, I felt like I didn't get to know them quite as much as the Kimi people. But they're very proud of their work, and they're very successful. And I think it's some things of, like, being public and being randomly entity listed by the U.S. They're just, like, immediately vaulted to a, whoa, you're, like, a real big company status type of thing that Kimi hasn't quite hit that level of. But in my mind, they're so similar. It's like, when I look at the models, they have different trade-offs. And it'll be interesting to see if that kind of diverges the cultures a bit more, if Kimi stays private longer and Zhipu is staying public.
Being listed on the secondary market probably sometimes make a difference, just normally get more attention.
Yeah, so Zhipu and Minimax are public now, and it's good because they can raise short term, but it's like, what if they need more capital to raise models? It's harder to do, like, you don't really do, like, a second public offering. Mm-hmm. It's kind of unclear. And right now the markets are really rewarding any AI company that's public, so there's so much demand to invest in it, but, like, that could turn. So, like, right now it's good. I don't know. I don't make those decisions, but you can make arguments both ways.
Earlier this year, there was a surge of API requests on OpenRouter for Kimi as well as Zhipu during the open call sensation. Do you think that trend will continue?
Yeah, we're seeing kind of multiple markets emerge. You have the Claude Code and Codex, which is, like, the top end. I describe it as, like, knowledge work tools. But essentially, there's going to be agents at price points for wherever they work. The thing that makes open models nice is that the price point is so low that the experimentation is much more doable. It's kind of a natural place where a lot of people will experiment on these models that are known to be strong and a step down in price while still having these established brands, which is where this whole DeepSeek, Zhipu, Kimi, Qwen kind of circle lands. Personally, I think, like, OpenClaw itself is a bit of a fad, where the name but the type of agent it represents will be sticking. So, like, right now, like, Hermes agent is far more popular, but it's like, even this will, like, come and go and there will be another. But it's just, like, this type of agent that you can run it and it is not super expensive on these, like, hosted models on OpenRouter is interesting. OpenRouter itself is not a huge proportion of the actual inference market. So, like, in the US, like, Fireworks and together are much bigger. They both started sharing some numbers on the amount of tokens they're doing every day. Mm-hmm. But OpenRouter is like more of like community oriented. So when you think about people that are following open models, it's like, well, that's where they think. And that obviously has an advantage. And I think companies are very actively leaning into it, because when their models surge on it, they use it. It's like good co-branding, and it feeds into itself.
And let's talk about your trip to Meituan and Xiaomi. Yeah, it's interesting because, as we discussed, the story is a very different. China is almost like Uber and Apple are developing their own open source models, but in the US, they are not. Why is this the case in China, though?
When you ask Meituan, when you feel like Meituan and Xiaomi's corporate position would be like, we're going to have agents that are used, you could think of it in Meituan, it's like an agent can do something for a user to figure out the ride to request or thing to order. Like, it can do this. And the first instinct in the US consumer would be, I'm just going to get an API key.
Exactly.
But in China, it's very much like, we can build this and
it
will be cheaper. Like, we have compute, we have talent, why don't we just try to build this? Mm-hmm. And this isn't specific to Meituan, but there's a few companies that are like, we build these general models, and that's not where like our use of them ends, but we can release the general model because more people will use it. And then what they do is they like fine-tune this to make specialized agents and specialized models, which they use for their services internally. And Meituan's a good example, where it's like those specialized models they don't release, but they hope to use them in their apps. And you can imagine this with Xiaomi, where it's like, it could power features in the car, and I'm guessing that Xiaomi works like a Tesla or something, where it communicates with the cloud, and there's all these interfaces. And you don't really know what this is be, but AI is going to be intermingled with like all digital technologies.
Yeah, I think Xiaomi is another good example of big corp is trying to do everything. It is doing like LLMs and robotics models, robotics hardwares. It is really like trying to do every single thing itself.
Yeah, it's like Xiaomi's models are pretty new too. They released a like 7B, their original MIMO model, in April to June of 2025. And then come December when they had their Flash V2 model, which was very popular. And then I think 2.5 was recently. It takes a long time for people to realize that these models are going to keep coming. And like, it's definitely surprising to see a new lab come from scratch. And they hired, I don't remember her first name, but like Fuji from DeepSeek. And
it's like, Luo Fuli.
And they seem on track to be like one of the best model builders from China. People in the US are mostly still at like DeepSeek, Qwen, Kimi, and ZAI. Some know of Minimax, some probably don't. And it's like, it's such a big list, but I expect, having visited Xiaomi, like I expect them to continue. It's like very no-nonsense. It makes sense for them to do this. They've done so many incredible things in the past. It's like building an AI model almost seems easier than building some of the cars and stuff that they have built.
I think for Meituan, they also invested in Moonshot's latest fundraising, which indicates Meituan is betting big on AI. Chinese companies just tend to have this massive ecosystem. They love the super app. They love the ecosystem. They love to build everything from scratch themselves. Do you think that's the right approach to go during the AI era?
It's worth to like try your hand at it. So I think AI, because it's so resource intensive, it by its nature will benefit very large companies and companies that can get onto this flywheel of like, we have a lot of resources. AI makes our products better. We get more returns on this. We can keep investing. Will win so much. I think in the US, it's really obvious to see like Google is winning. Mm-hmm. OpenAI and Anthropic will be fine. Like NVIDIA, obviously. Like all these companies that are in this feedback loop are going to be so good. And then it's interesting to see how this works in China. I think like Ant Group is along this way where they're building their models and they see how their platform spreads. Like right now, it's spreading into health. And they talked about this a lot. And they will surely also use their models there. And it's like for them, I think this actually makes a lot of sense. But when you look at a Western observer, you're like, why is Antling a thing? But they don't realize the like broad surface area that exists when you're using this Alipay thing. So it's like, I think for these companies with very large footprints, it actually does make sense. I worry that it suppresses some of this competition. So it's like, how did the smaller Kimis, Minimaxes, and ZAIs like fit into this ecosystem where such big apps exist. I think, right. like, I forget which one of the companies, but they were telling us how they, like, built an agent to navigate one of ByteDance's apps, and then ByteDance banned them because they couldn't yeah. take the data. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's interfaces emerging mm-hmm. between the small and the bigger companies, where the small companies are trying to find their niche. Definitely. And I feel like Meituan's in the middle, where I don't have a good grasp from my perspective, like, how big of a tech company it is. And it's like, is it going to get swallowed by consolidation, or is the spend going to be too much on the language models? Where I don't really know, but I'm pretty bullish on AI as a business. So I feel like most of these companies that are early are going to be okay, and they sell a lot of tokens, they sell intelligence, and there's going to be a lot of demand for it.
You wrote that Chinese companies have a technology ownership mentality. Can you explain that a little bit?
This goes to some of the, like, super app ideas, and they just see that they can build things and make it better, and if they succeed, they'll put more money into it and keep making it more efficient, and they'll tune it to their use cases. And this is like how the many domestic industries in China have grown over time to be some of the largest in the world. This is how it's kind of like they want to build rather than buy, if at all possible, so that they can kind of own the long-term trajectory. It's like a very, I think it's like Dan Wong of Breakneck said that, like, China's capitalism is more intense than the US, because it's like they're thinking of even longer term of what gives them the best margins and the ability to provide products and beat competitors. And, like, you don't beat somebody if you're relying on their service. And if you're hyper competitive, you have to do it all the best and do it all yourself. So that's what I think of it as, like, this ownership mentality of where it's not currently an impossible line item. I would say that they're probably spending 500 million to billions a year to make these models, which is a substantial amount of money, but not impossible mm-hmm. for these labs. It seems likely that the market will consolidate eventually if progress on capabilities keeps going up. It's like mm-hmm. capabilities is like log of investment, where it's like you have diminishing returns, but if you invest more, it gets smarter. But it's an interesting time where it's like, I remember I interviewed Richard from Antling, and he was like, yeah, it took us 6 months to set up this team to build these large models. So that's because there's all this talent in tech already, and they just, like, move the teams to do this. We're in the phase of, like, I don't know how long they will keep doing it. Mm. But for now, it's, like, kind of a fun thing.
Let's talk about, like, some other of the companies you visited. So, and Quinn and Alibaba. It's a big corp. It's different from Moonshot and other smaller labs. Right.
Yeah, so I think Quinn has won the hearts and minds of open source AI by releasing these small models consistently with incredible performance at all these sizes. Mm-hmm. They kind of were doing this before Llama 4 and before Llama faded, but they, like, really hit their stride right around the same time as Llama 4 happened and Meta paused. And they know this, so we ask them. It's like they think about things that developers will use. They want to keep building models that developers use and thrive on. But it's like when you look at Quinn, they haven't released their biggest models for a while. So it's like Quinn Plus and Quinn Max have been closed source. And this is very much of, like, the cloud side of Alibaba talking, mm-hmm. where just like the US, like, you see Google Cloud's crazy yeah. expenditures and crazy earnings. It's like Alibaba is the default in yeah. China for that to happen, and they yeah. know this. So, like, they're not going to release a model. Like, they might tell us, they might not release it because no one will use it. But also, it's like, I'm going to be like, look, you can make a lot of money on this. And I yeah. think there's a lot of money to be made in AI. Yeah. But I think the most interesting thing is hearing various people talk about them being intentional about these small models. And it's mm-hmm. like not an accident. Maybe it was at the beginning, or like, oh, let's try to do this thing somebody else is doing. But they have a very refined recipe of these 1 to 10 to 30 B models that are very popular. And that's intentional. And it's kind of nice to just, like, hear yeah. how they, like, they're like, yes, we do this. We understand it's a time sink, so it's hard to release models. It takes a lot of work in the ecosystem. And I think they felt that stress of, like, we could build more models, but if we build a model, we have to support it. We have right. to go to VLM, we have to go to all these companies in the open ecosystem, and, like, the modeling team is still pretty small, and it's like they don't have a way to, like, outsource that work. It's somebody very close to building the model still does this. Yeah. There's the two ends of caution, is, like, you can release too many models, and also, like, they haven't been releasing the biggest models because they want to monetize them in the cloud. Part of going into China for this trip, one of the other questions was, like, is AI investment kind of like a SaaS, like this software as a service thing, mm-hmm. or closer to a cloud spend? Because
right.
one of the, whether or not it's a trope or actually true, is that the views in the US is that China doesn't spend on these services, where it's like the Slack equivalent is much smaller, and people maybe just, like, rebuild minimal software in-house or download something, and much less willing to pay this like per head, per seat monthly cost on software. But all these companies do run on the cloud. Like Alibaba has a large business, and like a lot of modern software you need via the cloud. I think that China will shift to be more of viewing that AI spend is like this cloud spend. It might not be as exorbitant as the spend in the US, but they'll view it as needed spend to make the technology that they want to make. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's like these clouds will exist.
It's so interesting because when you arrive at the Shanghai airport or you take the high-speed train to Hangzhou, you will see the Alibaba cloud, like a commercial banner.
I walked into Beijing, and the first thing I saw was like Alibaba cloud something. I'm like, okay, here I am.
I think one difference between Alibaba cloud and AWS is that actually Bedrock carry every single big model and their own model and smaller models at the same time. But for China cloud, they only carry their own models.
That's a big difference. And I think that this neo-cloud market in the US, where there's just like a lot more people reselling other people's models as tokens or reselling compute, is like a huge part of the US market. You could name so many companies. It's like CoreWeave, Nebius, Together, Fireworks, Lambda.
Yeah.
Like there's going to be way more. We talked about OpenRouter. And like, I don't know any of the equivalents of those in China.
I don't think they
so that's have. A. Yeah. Those companies are largely looked at as being supported by NVIDIA in a lot of ways. Like NVIDIA likes to prioritize the diversity of the ecosystem because it's better for them to not have most of their revenue be from OpenAI, like those few companies. And it seems like that dynamic is not the same.
Yeah, that one is interesting because you are missing this layer in China. They don't have the infrastructure or the optimization layer.
Because you look at the likes of what a trend we're seeing now is like Cursor took the Kimi model and they post-trained it within the Fireworks like RL sandbox training environment and serve it with Fireworks. And like that's a really interesting multi-party collaboration to build a very strong model and product, which might have to be like more verticalized in China to get the same thing done.
Probably like Chinese companies just want to have everything in-house.
Yeah, it goes against the ownership and the integration where it's like in order to support a company that operates in these middle layers, you have to be okay with like offloading a important thing, whether it's GPU hosting or inference, because you want to focus on something else. And that just seems like a more Western startup style of things than otherwise.
Yeah.
I do think a lot of the model labs in China are going to be more willing to try different things than the bigger and older tech companies in China, because Kimi knows Cursor, trains their model. Like they will go talk to Cursor and stuff like this.
And 01.ai, founded by Kai-Fu Lee, they now experienced a major transition to a total like 2B kind of business model. Where do you see the future for China's 2B market during the AI era?
It goes back to if these relationships can kind of be formed. So I think a lot of them are wondering if they can hit the kind of use this global to business software market. I feel like it's so hard for me to make a bet domestically whether or not it'll win. I think that, like, yes, you can take AI expertise and build it within another company and it'll be very valuable for the company that had less AI expertise, but it's like whether or not this willingness to like you're losing ownership if you're relying on an external partner to do this. It's like the latest trend in the US is like forward deployed engineers. This is buzzword FDEs. And it's like OpenAI is hiring a ton and stuff like this where it's like gonna happen in the US, but it's like, is that gonna be a like viable thing where you can go through the front door of a company and actually get welcomed to them? It's very interesting. It's like they're gonna try this, and I think that like if it works, being the first one to retry it in the AI era is going to obviously be so useful. But I'm like, I have no idea. Like I could flip a coin. I'd be like, it depends entirely on kind of this like Chinese culture of the business that I can't fully understand.
Yeah, but whom did you meet with?
We met with Kai-Fu Lee.
How was the conversation?
It was good. It's like such a legend to meet him, and it's so cool to be able to see people like that. And he's like, it's focused. Like he could do. He's done so much in his life. He could do whatever he wants or not work. And it's like to see him like trying to solve a problem and figure out how to reimagine his business is like a very AI type thing where it's like it's just drawn all these people back to like try to think about what the next phase of building businesses is going to look like.
Why Kaifu's lab failed to become the leading lab in China?
I don't really know. You should ask him.
Yeah. That's a tough question.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of opportunity for doing things with AI, and building models is a different type of culture. The building models is very much like turning the crank and continuing to ratchet up the resource rungs. And I don't think it's just 0-1 AI that is like built a model and then stops. I think like in the US, like Databricks was building models, and then they were like, no need for us to do this. Other people have got the bill. I don't know if they're on the record, but I think a lot of leadership at Databricks would tell you this. We're like, we're happy to not pay for building this model, and we're going to do our business. And I think that's why I'm surprised that so many companies have kept doing this like 1 trillion parameter MOE, which is way more expensive. Like 0-1 AI and Databricks got out at like small MOEs or small dense models. It's like way less investment.
Yeah.
So in some ways it might seem smart if you thought that you were not going to be competitive. It's better to stop earlier than later.
Not everyone needs to have or to build the best model, right?
Yeah.
A cliched question. How many months do you think US SOTA models are ahead of the Chinese models? And for that gap, is it going to become narrower or wider? Why?
So on traditional benchmarks, it's been like 6 to 9 months for a while. In real world use, especially early in reasoning models, it was very tight because it was a new paradigm. And it's like when you're in a new paradigm, the rewards to doing it are so steep. Both US and Chinese labs were climbing this really fast rate of improvement, and the Chinese labs released sooner. So you talk to somebody at a Chinese lab, they're like, our model's still in RL. It takes about a week to do this last RL run, and then we'll release it within like a day of it being done. Where the US labs have some process that normally takes weeks to get the model out. So if you think about it, you're on like steep progress, you have two different lines, and it's like if China's behind, but you don't have this like no progress, horizontal is when you're waiting to release it. So China releases it faster, so it kind of like converges the performance that users get. So at the end of the day, the performance gap is like the models that are available to people. And through this conversation, we've talked about a few things. Like some is like this knowledge work domain, which is all these US workers and things like this, which I think realistically the raw utility of the US frontier models are just like a bit more robust in a way that's been hard to measure. So it's hard to know on the benchmark numbers. I think the 6 to 9 months on like the benchmarks that are popular will become stable, but there's this like intangible unmeasurable where the US models will pull ahead. The best example is like this Claude Code and Codex revolution that started in December and January, where it's like it'll be very obvious if an open weight model enables this type of behavior because everybody in the world will be talking about it, which is like I can pay $1 a month instead of OpenAI's $200 a month. Like a lot of people are going to switch. And as of recording, that's say like 5 to 6 months. And I just like don't really expect that like really clear watershed this year, which will like shed some light on the gap and how like the way we're looking at the gap is like a bit narrow to how AI is used in a really broad set of use cases now.
Why haven't we seen a really good Chinese coding model as of yet?
I think a lot of what's popular with Claude Code and Codex is that they're just very easy to use. Mm-hmm. And I think the Chinese labs will keep solving coding, so like the actual code quality of the models will be incredibly high, and that's based on like public data and things like GitHub and stuff like this, and you create puzzles, the model learns to solve there. But it's in this like ease of use thing that the US labs have had a really big lead, and there's a difference in how they operate where the US labs get consumer data. So like Cursor trains their model on people using Cursor, and ChatGPT and Codex and Claude Code are the same. Well, all these open weight labs, they release a model and they have their CLIs that are a bit less popular, but a lot of the usage of the model just doesn't go back to the developer. So some of it is a bit of like that real world data is really useful to kind of making the model more robust across general circumstances. And that's where the closed labs have a huge advantage.
Cool. And I do have some open source model questions. Why are Chinese labs releasing so many strong open source models?
It's a path to relevance. I think they know they're behind and they know they want to become more in the conversation. And if no one knows about you and you have an API, nobody thinks about your model. But in a world where AI models are so valuable and pretty rare, when you release them openly, there's a lot of people that are like, oh, I wish I had my own AI model, that are going to take a look and try it. So all the labs are really practical. It's like, this is our way to be in the story of like what is happening at the frontier of AI, and they will keep doing this. And I expect this to be stable because I expect this like fast follow gap to continue. And this is why it's like a very practical mindset. It's like, there's not much added risk to us doing it. It helps us accomplish our goals. It's the only way to get some customers. So like, we've got to do it.
If Meta fails to become the best open model, does it mean the US actually is losing open model leadership to China?
In the last year, US has ceded the open model leadership to China, I think especially in the summer of 2025, when a bunch of these new Chinese labs were starting to get really prominent. That's when GLM 4.5 and Kimi K2 came out as their breakthrough models. And like from that point on, like the US no longer had open model leadership, and that's been the case, I think, since summer of 2025. Anyone claiming otherwise is a little bit deluded on where the models are coming from that actually matter.
Does US still have the chance to catch up?
They do, because they have NVIDIA, and NVIDIA's financial interest is to not have AI be owned by any one company. And the best way to do this is to release open models for the world.
So the only hope is NVIDIA?
Realistically, potentially, like in open models, like I think there's the likes of Meta and Microsoft where they have products, whether user or enterprise, that are supported by AI, so they could release open weight models. It wouldn't really hurt their businesses, but they chose not to in recent years. Maybe it's a distraction, maybe it's like a marketing and security risk or something, but so long as that stays, I think NVIDIA is best positioned to change this. As of recording, like a couple days ago or yesterday, and Jensen announced their Nemotron 3 Ultra model. The way I think about this is like, that's the completion of the first arc to NVIDIA starting to try open models again, where they had these Nemotron 3 Nano, Super, and Ultra, which is their like mixture of expert models, and Ultra is the biggest one, which they will then use to make synthetic data and all sorts of smaller models and distillation in-house. So now that they have their first big model established, they have a lot more flexibility in building other sizes of models and continuing to improve it. And this is where it will be more interesting to see their open model efforts. It's like, once somebody gets to this big MOE, can they keep kind of scaling it from there? Where NVIDIA had a lot of models in the past that were like, were good, but kind of fell out of the usage or coverage cycle a bit more quickly.
How about some smaller players like Reflection AI? Or maybe you guys?
Yeah, so I think there will be many more people building models in the open, and the open ecosystem can support like a diversity of models. So these smaller, medium-sized models are very useful because they're so cheap. And if you can get them to do one task repeatedly, you're going to save so much money over using Claude or Codex. And why, like, there's kind of a fixation in open models of chasing the frontier, which is these big MOE models, which is the Nemotron Ultra, Kimi K2, and whatever. So I think that's kind of something where over time that fixation on the largest model will fade. So like Reflection wants to build a big model, but it's like people competing with Qwen that will win the hearts and minds, which is a small model that every single researcher in the world is building off of. Like the extent that AI research right now is done on Qwen is incredible. It was Llama for a long time, but it's like everybody, like all the researchers know how Qwen works at that scale. They're used to using it. And that's like a really remarkable achievement for them. I think it's like not talked about enough. Mm-hmm. And I think over time that distribution from small to big will have more levels of interest. And I think like for a Reflection, it might be better to like pick a niche that's less served. And like AI2 builds small OMO models, which are great for research. And it's like, I don't think AI2 should chase the frontier and try to build a 1 trillion parameter model. I think philanthropically it's not possible, but also it's just like good to do something strategically different than, like, there's time to fill different niches before people realize they can't financially keep up with the frontier.
Who has the best China open source models?
It goes back and forth. I think that I personally want to spend more time playing with the various models. I would say that the best models are like Kimi and ZAI. So like Kimi K2.6 and GLM 5.1 are probably the ones that I hear most as like actually making a difference at the frontier of usage. But it ebbed so fast. Like I think all of 2025, DeepSeek was the like unanimous king with the best models, particularly like their V3 and R1 lines. And I wouldn't be surprised if Xiaomi was to take a crown. In China, Qwen's biggest models have been closed. That has held back some of their adoption in mind share at the biggest sizes. But I don't know. If you put a gun to my head, I would say Kimi and ZAI as of today are the best open models in the world.
But the competition is intense, right? Yeah, that changes
very fine margins.
You mentioned that a lot of Chinese researchers in your article. Tell us about your impression on them. How are they different from the US AI labs?
There's so much talent in China, whereas you go to a lab and it's mostly like Chinese researchers grew up in China. They're often younger. We went to a lot of places near Tsinghua, and there's other great universities. So it's like you go to the labs. For one, it's way more uniform in who is there. It's like a lot of Chinese researchers is like here at AI2 or anywhere. I'm like, I feel like I work with all sorts of people. And as somebody who is like not a immigrant or parents were an immigrant in the US, I'm like, I feel a little bit unusual. It's like I work with people from all over the world, whether it's Europe, Middle East, China, other places in Asia. And that's in the US labs, that's also the case. There's a lot of Chinese researchers in the US.
Right.
But that's like the population level is like, that's definitely a different feeling there. And then I think there's some of these things we talked about earlier, where a lot of the like top US researchers are like talking about where AI will be going, this kind of philosophical or artistic design of models. And I think it's an example that the organizer of the trip, Kathryn Rintoul, pointed out is that like the likes of Amanda Askell that are talking about like model character and really crafting the tone of the models, it's like that whole conversation didn't really come up in China. It's like there's some pockets there where the topics they talk about or like how far they're willing to project where AI is going is pretty different. Otherwise, it's so similar. I think the things that are more interesting China specific is like the newest generation of researchers in China seem like even better at speaking English. Like so many of these really young people speak incredible English, and they all follow the Western AI ecosystem on Twitter and read blogs, and they're all writing these papers, where the opposite is not true, where it's like the US ecosystem, a lot of people just have no, like they don't think about what's happening in China. They don't, like, it's hard to get reliable information, or what I feel like is, of what's happening in the Chinese tech ecosystem, even if somebody's like really interested in it and wants to know how these companies navigate. So there's these very different information flows that will feed into how people think. But also it's like a fairly American character trait to be like very proud of the stuff around you and like slightly boastful. It's like a very American thing, and it's like, oh, the Silicon Valley kind of like rewards people for doing this, and it's like a bit tunnel vision in a way, where Silicon Valley is obviously developing its own narrow culture and discussion around AI with the like permanent underclass nonsense, and now it's the recursive self-improvement and the singularity. There's sprinkles of this when you visit the Chinese labs, but way less. They like got part of it from the US, and like, oh, that's a little weird, but we'll be entertained by it. But when you go to SF, it's like, that's really what people talk about. It's like senior PhD students are like, oh, I need to make my money now. I need to join a lab. There's this very intense culture in SF around the timeliness of AI and how their career is changing that didn't feel the same in China, where they're like, we're going to do this. Maybe a bit more down to earth in that regard, it's like less anxious about things.
But how do you view Chinese AI talent in the current wave? I mean, like if you even look at the leading frontier AI labs in the US, you will see a lot of Chinese researchers, right? Chinese American researchers working there after completing their PhDs. They might be immigrants, they might be second generation immigrants. What kind of roles are Chinese talents actually playing in the AI research today?
They're in every company playing crucial roles. Like, I think the US current political stances to limit high skill immigration is bad for the country. Like, I work with a lot of Chinese or international people, and I think that I want them to be able to live in the country where I like to live, and I would I disagree with the policy that is going on.
Yeah.
And I think anyone that works in tech knows how crucial this talent is, and I think there's worries, as for example there was recent news about like exit bans on passports for some of the top executives at AI companies, and people in the US that are sensitive to how important this talent is and the rising geopolitical tension will worry, like, what if they call back the top researchers because the US companies will be severely hurt. Like, that's the reality of it. I don't know if that call gets made at all in the near term. That is not remotely near the circles of people who listen to this podcast. Like, that's not who makes that decision. But, like, people talk about this stuff in the US as being a major potential bottleneck on the tech industry's progress.
It looks like you only need one person to lead the team, right? Then you have that model to be ready.
Vision is hard. So an undersold thing about building language models is that so much of it is an org chart problem where you have talent and you want to make the model better. And the hard thing is organizing the talent and figuring out how to break down the big problems into little problems where a lot of talent can funnel into this one model. Mm. I don't know if I'm ready to state this like really strongly, but it like could be the way that Chinese engineers are trained, that they like are more suited to making these org charts where it's just like they're just going to grind on their little thing and be happy that it contributes to the bigger model. I think there's a lot of uncertainty in this because like how the frontier labs actually work is not that well documented, and it might just be more of chaos where it's just like people running around trying to make the model all the time. It's like not the best analogy, but it's like, it's definitely a org chart limited, or you have to get all these people into this one thing.
Yeah. Are Chinese AI researchers more willing to drop old assumptions and just absorb the latest paradigm? If you look at MoE, RL agents, coding models, and tool use, for example, MoE wasn't invented by DeepSeek, but the company optimized the technology in an extremely effective way.
I think this is something that's more of just with new and like youthful motivated researchers. There's a very grim saying that's like science advances one funeral at a time, which is like the most bleak way of saying it, but this is just that like new people are much more willing to accept the newest things, and they have no reason to defend their old ideas because they have no established track record and they want to dive in and take these things. And to the extent that China is potentially younger and both through engineering talent and leadership, like those people just have less priors, and therefore it might be true. It's something that if you're trained in science, it's like the younger you are, like that's where a lot of the new ideas and change comes from.
For Chinese culture, doesn't mean it is harder to cultivate someone who is truly visionary. For example, Elias Suscaver, that level of leading expert.
That's the impression that I have, and the impression is built on like understanding that the culture is built on like standardized testing from such a young age, and some of these tests rewarding memorization. Students know that like if they make this test, they get to go to the best school at the next rung, and they always are this like super competitive thinking about this kind of gate in their progress. And correct me if my understanding of the Chinese system is wrong, but that's my understanding, where the US ecosystem has like less of these gates where it's like your fate is decided as better or worse, and it's more of a continuum where a lot of the best people go to the best schools and the second best schools are also very good and they blend through each other. And yes, there's credentialism, but maybe a bit less extreme. So I think it's very possible that that is the case. And some of the leadership would off the record talk about this, of like this rewards memorization. And it's very hard to rework an education system, despite if you want to.
Yeah.
Some tech leaders you talked to off the record said that that was the case, and I was like, okay, I have no reason to not believe you.
You describe Chinese labs as almost perfectly set up to be fast followers. Can you explain that? What makes them execute so fast?
Yeah, this is what I was talking about, the various things on the young talent and the culture of just like being very technically driven and focused on their task, and potentially like they're just lock in on this thing and they have abundant talent, where it's like you can just have people working across the whole stack and funnel it into a model. And we've seen this many times. It's like once you know that something is possible, it's a bit easier to do this. And we've seen Chinese tech economies come for other things. It's like you go into like Xiaomi's technology, you go into it, it feels like an Apple store. It's very likely they're inspired by the iPad and the iPhone and their designs, and they're good at it. Like, they've done this not just in AI, and I'm like, I expect them to do it in AI again. And the debate is whether or not like them doing this fundamentals to keep redoing it is enough for them to like, people like to wonder, it's like, oh, is China gonna leapfrog the US AI labs? Mm-hmm. And I think that in an equal resource world, they might be able to, or they're just like, they have more talent that's willing to work more hours over a 5 to 10 year time frame. But I think human talent is only one of the resources that it takes to build these models, and just like capital through mostly compute and data is actually like the biggest lever. And it seems like they're disproportionately fewer resources than the US hyperscale companies. So it's like, I think talent will only take them so far, but the technology diffuses, where the best models make it easier to make more efficient models. So it just kind of like is this going to keep propelling through there.
Can a fast follower become the frontier leader?
They can. I think AI is weird because of the resource requirement. I think China's path to leadership is by it taking a long time to get to the final destination, and that's time where Huawei builds out its capacity, and then its net capacity becomes bigger. It's a common scenario you'll hear in people talking about balance of power and chips. So I think that most people think that it would be a long haul for that to happen, but don't rule it out.
As we talk about the leading AI scientists, culture difference, you know, here in the US, right? But I think back to China, maybe Xiaomi is an exception with Luofu Li being quite active on social media as well as podcasts. There was also Lin Junyang from Qwen. He was the tech lead of Qwen. He left the company earlier this year. Especially for Lin Junyang, I think there was apparent conflict between what's called the individualism and collectivism, which prioritizes the company's interests per se. Do you see more of that kind of conflict coming out from the China labs?
Going into this Western ecosystem, I think some of the researchers will find that they are very well suited to this. So I call him Justin, the American name, and it's like, he was so good at this. And I kind of see it as something we've also seen in America, where it's like people in tech companies that can get a lot of influence externally as well can push against leadership, and the big tech companies are like, we don't need to listen to you, so then like they part ways. Like we've seen it,
like Yama Klin, right?
Like we've seen it in the US. I think a prominent example was around like some of the AI ethics researchers at Google, where it's like Timnit sent an ultimatum to Google leadership and they said no, and it's like there's walls that you can hit within big tech companies that are hard to hit. And I think that like some of these Chinese researchers will probably like get fed into this ecosystem, and we might see some of it again. But for startups, the startups like Kimi or ZAI would love to have a person that is bringing noise and bringing attention. You just figure it all out later. Very much depends on the company size. But I think it would be good if more of the Chinese researchers get into this, because it's good to have more views in like this whole part of the world if they can be seen in the US, so more people understand how they think and how they approach models. It would be good for the kind of global equilibrium.
Yeah, that's great. We're trying to do that. We're trying to invite more Chinese researchers coming to our show.
Yeah.
So subscribe our channel. And when you talk to the Chinese researchers, right, what was the mode inside the Chinese AI labs? Did you see more confidence, anxiety, curiosity, or something more practical?
I think there's definitely an anxiety of not being able to keep up in compute. So I think it's like all the Chinese labs want more NVIDIA compute to train the latest models. And the researchers are the people who feel this most. It's like they're the people that are hitting the resource constraints. But otherwise, there's less social anxiety. I think in the US, there's a big upswell of social anxiety, whether it's people I work with here that are seriously concerned about their job being replaced. And I'm like, you're one of the best AI researchers I know. But like, even people like this will be like, I'm really, really concerned about this. And this is in the broader discourse where American CEOs are going around talking about how people are going to lose their jobs, which is not a good messaging decision. But that's like very deeply embedded in how people think about AI now and the data center discussion. It doesn't seem like any of these cultural shelling points has landed in China. Some of the developers are like, we ask them, what is AGI? And they're like, when they take my job. And they're not like, it's not like a cloud hanging over them. They're like, I want to build this thing and figure it out later.
Why is that?
There's some hesitancy around developers, or like, this is changing a lot. They all use Claude, which is supposedly banned in China. They all use it to do their work, and they told us very forthcomingly, like, we love Claude. Like, Claude's the best model. So there's definitely some hesitancy growing around like software jobs are changing, but it's much less of a collective like social opinion on AI is bad and disruptive. Like, that doesn't feel like it's established in China at all. I think that some of them discussed how they've been living through so many technological changes in rapid succession as the company makes so much progress technologically and economically, where they're like, this is like the next one, where they've had so many with these, like the Chinese mega apps, like they have electric cars now. Like, they're just kind of like, oh, this is just how it is. Where in the US, it's like these changes have come with more cadence in between them, and then like the latest one, and there's kind of like more inertia that it's gonna have to move aside.
Were people talking about alignment at all, safety issue at all within Chinese labs?
The word that's used more is security, where the companies definitely care about this, but it was much less front of mind. It was like, if we're releasing model weights, we want to make sure that it's not enabling any gigantic new risk. And we would poke at, like, what about multimodal models? And we're like, yeah, some of these things have moved to be risks a bit faster, but it's much less of this big text LLM agent that we're releasing is a major risk, and therefore we need to, like, not release it. They would say reasonable things about this, but it was not, like, in the US it can almost sound like ideological and, like, deep rooted concern that, like, AI, like, the next AI is going to be the one that is of a lot of concern. So I think it's measured, but not very front of mind.
Yeah, probably, like, Chinese are just being more practical.
I felt like it was reasonable. I was like, that's kind of my stance. It's like, I support open models, but I'm not an absolutist. It's like, I don't think every model should necessarily be open. Claude Mythos is a bit of a, like, marketing stunt, but also it's like an incredible breakthrough model. It would not be good if that was just uploaded to Hugging Face the first day that they had it. Like, it takes time for technology to diffuse, and access diffusing over time for transformative things is reasonable, and the equilibrium we're in right now where the closed models are ahead and open models follow, it, like, seems like a good way to get technology into the world. And I think that a lot of these companies would feel similarly.
Which parts do you think Chinese labs are genuinely ahead of the US labs today, and which parts are they not ahead but moving faster than Americans expect?
So a lot of people say the Chinese labs are building more efficient models, and I think that's kind of overblown because the US labs are serving way more tokens at inference, so they're way more incentivized. Like, the financial gain to make Claude or ChatGPT 1% more effective is like billions of dollars. So I think they have, like, more reasons to be efficient. But I think the Chinese labs, by doing it longer, have a bit better understanding of, like, how people are using their open models. And we talk to people at Alibaba, and they're very intentional about this. But also now the likes of Kimi and ZAI and all of these others with these established MOEs that have multiple cycles, they're following how people are using their models. And this expertise is very transient. Like, I try to figure out, like, how are people using Olmo, and it's like a mess. It's like, it's really hard to get the direct information, but it is what makes their model successful or not. Obviously, there's benchmarks, but then it's like, why did Cursor choose the Kimi model? Kimi's going to think about that really deeply or ask them, and this is, like, very valuable expertise at the frontier of AI that's hard to get. So they, like, know what makes a bit better open model or not, and you only get this from releasing models a lot. So I think, like, NVIDIA is building momentum on releasing models, and they'll start to get more of this feedback. And then there's reflection in the US that's like, we'll release a model when it's ready, but they're going to get none of this feedback of people actually use the model, and yes, this benchmark is good, but this very related thing doesn't work, why? And I think that's, like, the intangible knowledge of how the open ecosystem works is consolidating there right now.
Let's move to the opposite case. What are the biggest disadvantage that the Chinese labs still face today? Is it still GPU?
Yeah, it's compute. There's likely incorrect estimates, but you could say something like Meta or OpenAI have more GPUs than all of these, like, Chinese companies combined, and they very well likely do. And I've heard rumors that say, like, an OpenAI researcher can get like 5,000 GPUs for themselves. And this is, like, would be a major proportion of a Chinese open model lab's research budget. So I think their aperture for risk and amount of dynamic things they can do algorithmically is much more narrow. And I think they're sort of see, like, just optimizing the current path of the models is much more of a necessity because they know they can keep making this better. But it's a less dynamic ecosystem. One of the Chinese labs told us, like, their latest pre-training run took like 6 months. And this is a model that's out on Hugging Face. And it's like, if that run didn't work, like, that whole line of models just, like, wouldn't exist. And that is a very precarious position to be for the company. And I think that they're exceeding most people's expectations with the amount of compute that they have, but that is the limiting factor.
And yes, the Chinese labs are desperate for more NVIDIA GPU chips. How much does compute scarcity change their model strategy?
The biggest thing is that every model, you essentially design it based on how you expect it to be used downstream, and then what the shape of your training clusters is. So, like, the training cluster will configure how efficient it is to train a different size of model, and then you also know you need to serve it. So based on probably having smaller clusters, which is going to change how they do make these types of decisions, or maybe they can change their base model architecture less frequently because pre-training runs take longer. And I do think that we're going to see, for some of these smaller labs, I think Alibaba and ByteDance, with the resources they have, is a bit different, but like Minimax, Moonshot, et cetera, like most expectations are Claude and GPTs are at this like 3 to 6 trillion parameter range. And I think it'll be a lot harder for them to scale up unless they're getting these like latest NVL 72 racks and Blackwell chips and things like this. Mm-hmm. So essentially there's ceilings to these, but it's a multi-optimization problem, whether it's like, what's your training cluster? What's your inference stack? They might want it to work on Huawei inference now.
Right.
And like, who are your users? So they do all of these things, and we see the output as a model on Hugging Face of like 600 billion to a trillion parameters. It's hard to map, but it's one of the most interesting decisions in a lab, and most people won't tell you.
Yeah. So does compute scarcity force better efficiency, or does it ultimately cap the frontier?
It does, but it's more of like you're changing how you work. Like everybody wants compute efficiency, because if you have a more efficient research, if you make your experimental unit half the price, you run twice as many experiments. So there's like a lot of very basic math where every AI researcher wants this. It's hard to say that the Chinese labs would necessarily be better at it. It's like maybe because they have less inference compute, they train a model that's more efficient at inference, and that has a different trade-off. I think DeepSeek's famous for these like memory-saving innovations, like some of which are used everywhere now. But it like might just be overkill when you compare it. Like a U.S. lab might look at that and be like, it would give us a small gain, but it's not worth the effort or something.
Yeah. So how good are domestic accelerators such as Huawei chips in practice? I heard many people saying it's ready for inference, but not for training.
That's mostly the consensus. We would go to some more random companies, so not like core LLM, and they're like, yeah, we have to have Huawei, we don't use it. But most of the LLM language model companies we talk to are established enough where it's like they all have services that people are signing up for, or ZAI serves trillions of tokens a day on their API. And all of those companies are like, if you can give me Huawei chips, we will maybe get more customers, and they are figuring out how to use them for inference. But on training, it's only like very small models that could be trained on Huawei, and I personally expect that to be the status quo for a while. That's why researchers focused on training are like, I would like more NVIDIA chips.
Yeah. A while is how long?
Ask a semiconductor expert, but I would expect order of years where it's like still NVIDIA is so far ahead. Because NVIDIA is channeling the global supply chain into making the top-end products versus necessity is the mother of invention at Huawei. And it's like, how far did they get? I don't know.
How do you see the recent debate between Jensen and Darkesh? For people who are not very familiar with the context, Jensen argued against the strict limits on Chinese access to NVIDIA GPUs, saying that China already has the energy infrastructure, chip production capabilities, and AI talent to develop advanced models. Independently, he said that restricting sales only cuts NVIDIA off from a massive market while failing to stop China's technology process. While Darkesh was holding the China threat theory, and of course Jensen is biased because he wants to sell more chips in China, right? But whom do you think is right?
I think realistically I'm in the middle and more on Dwarkesh's side. It ends up being a geopolitical discussion, which is like, Do you think AI is a technology that is going to be used for this? And it's like, I would rather see what is traditional American values of like freedom of expression and all these things spread into the world. And I think that giving AI chips to China does pose some level of risk in this capacity, until, like, on the balance of power. As an American, that's how I've fallen on this.
Yeah.
It's hard to know like to what extent. So when you listen to people within NVIDIA, they essentially are saying there's no more power to build in the US, therefore no one in the US would buy these chips, so we want to sell them to China. But at the same time, you have US companies asking for more allocation and US policymakers talking to constituents who are like, the US companies would have bought more. So I kind of talk to both parties, which is these US labs that are like, I want more chips to sell my companies. And I talk to policy researchers at NVIDIA where they're like, the US can't support more volume. So it's so hard to get the ground truth information of like, how much would the US buy and what is the diverted to this Chinese market. this is why like I end up with big error bars because I don't know who exactly like, what the equilibrium is, and therefore there's some chips that NVIDIA definitely wouldn't sell in the US, and we should tell them China and support NVIDIA's AI leadership. So I don't know.
The question I'm more curious is that will the ban encourage better AI chips in China, which
definitely.
Is the Huawei chips, right?
So, it's definitely the case. We talked earlier about this, like software as a service versus cloud, and I think like AI is going in the cloud direction, and this is going to support all sorts of new companies in China that need this cloud in order to build their viable products. And there's going to be this growing inference demand. We talk about open cloud, we talk about cloud code. Like the inference demand is there. I think China is earlier on the adoption. So you talk to developers in China and they're like, I use Claude. Like this is getting routed to what is Western capacity. And it's like, as China unlocks more domestic AI inference capacity in these use cases, like this demand will all funnel into how many chips can Huawei make. So like,
yeah.
This is coming in months, not years. Like there will be new apps like Claude Code that are so enabling in China that people have crazy demand for them. So I see this happening in this capacity. Jensen is somewhat right, where it's like that is what's going to drive the local AI stack to be developed. Like the local labs have Huawei chips that they're designing inference for. Like in some ways it's happening, and it's just a ratio of how much and to what extent is okay for people.
So the bottleneck is really on the production capacity for Huawei, right?
Yeah, and the ecosystem for how easy it is to actually run a model on these chips, so which is the
CUDA level.
So I think like I'm very bullish on AI demand continuing to increase. So therefore like demand creates this need.
Anthropic CEO Daryl Amodei has consistently positioned himself as one of the most vocal tech leaders warning about the national security and geopolitical threats posed by Chinese AI development. How do you see his approach?
I think it's a little too aggressive. Like I think that some of Anthropic Media is pretty careful about separating the concerns from Chinese government and Chinese individual scientists, but it's a little too aggressive in the near term about like risks posed by open weight models and so on. So I think it could be a little off-putting to people to hear him kind of be the tip of the spear in that regards.
And you mentioned that the China's weakness in the AI data industry is more important than people realized. Can you elaborate more on that?
One of the most surprising things is that the data industry is much less developed in China. So when we flew this whole environments craze, so to say, where companies like Anthropic and OpenAI are saying that they have billions of dollars of data budget to buy environments from external vendors, we asked the companies and they're like, no, we don't really have this. We build some in-house. People would point to the likes of ByteDance and Alibaba being bigger and being able to build internal data teams. But there's very little talk of like you go and buy some data from an external vendor, which is so normal in the US. Like the Frontier Lab playbook, if you take it a little like cynically in training the models, it's like the model is bad at something, then you go to try to buy some data for it and you see if the data makes the eval go up. And that's like kind of a cynical take on US Frontier Labs, is like the boring stuff that they do. They do much more exciting things, but that dynamic doesn't seem to exist in China. That looks like the biggest difference. It's like obviously OpenAI researchers have more compute than Chinese researchers, and then therefore these Chinese startups, the people work on different problems and maybe it looks like more efficient solutions and so on. But the data one was the only one that was like, okay, this didn't necessarily need to be different and felt very different. How people currently view US Frontier models is that they're going into this like knowledge work tool. So like as a nominal knowledge worker, like I use Claude Code and Codex to now mediate the vast majority of my work. And people see this happening for healthcare, law, consulting, finance. And the US models are all gonna push into this capacity. And a lot of the training data for this comes through these data company networks where they're giving money to professionals to
like
create this
AI
training data. Yeah, there's a whole market of Scale AI, Merkur, Surge, Turing. There's a whole plethora of companies here, and the market is pushing them away from offshored preference data for RLHF into this very high-skill labor industry. And this is like a huge, it's measured in billions of dollars of how much people are paying for this across each model lab. And they do this because it serves value and makes the models better at these agentic tasks. And I think it's a question of, like, do the Chinese labs unlock this domestic market for their own agents and people do using their models for this, because that demand is what will let them buy this data that's very expensive, versus if the Chinese AI researchers and then knowledge workers are like, I'm using Claude. Like, Claude is just has all the more reason to keep doing this in the US, and that's all for the US data industry. So, like, it's, I talk to my friends that do post-training at labs, and like, these data companies are like really important to getting this like incremental performance bump on all of these domains. And if so, if it doesn't exist in China, I'm like, you're gonna have to be very creative to make, like, an AI researcher is then gonna be making up an environment and data of, say, like a finance problem of like making an Excel spreadsheet. And I just don't think this is a task that an AI researcher is naturally suited to do. It's like a different world than they live in.
I have a few more questions about Chinese demand and business model. You know, like during the mobile internet era, Chinese companies are so good at launching new apps, applications. You know, people would say companies like Meituan, WeChat, and Alibaba totally changed our daily lives. And assumption is that China will move faster this time as well on AI applications once the models are ready. Do you see that coming?
I think both in the US and China, there's going to be incredible dynamism in the applications. I think some arguments are even like the US consumer is more used to adding new apps and then like going through the, like getting very used to it and paying for it than in China, where they have these mega apps. And it's a question of like, can the mega apps support the same amount of diversity of new use cases? Where in the US, you have things like Sora, which is the number one app and millions of people try it, and then, it's a flop. Like, and it's its own sandbox. It can be a more defined experience. So I would almost say in the software side, the US is more set up for like this dynamic trial of new apps.
Were Chinese labs worried about monetization at all?
Not super vocally, but we also didn't ask. Mm-hmm. I also don't think that many of the like frontier AI labs are that obsessed with monetization. OpenAI and Anthropic want to IPO.
Yeah.
But most people building AI models are just like, I want to build the best model. And you assume the model's going to get better, like they're so useful, the funding won't be a problem.
Depends on whom you ask, right? If you ask a product manager, probably they're concerned about
or the leadership that's trying to support buying more compute.
Should US labs visit China labs more often?
I think we'll see some US, especially small and medium players that are trying to build economic value around open models, whether it's a fine-tuning API or specialized deployments or so on, want to build relationships with Chinese labs because the Chinese labs are so open to sharing their technology and expertise. After traveling to China, we've seen, like, I've gotten inbound from a lot of companies that are like, how do you get access to all these labs? We would go visit. And this is you could look up a known either infra or training company in the US that works on top of open models, where if this evolves, it'll be kind of a new era of these new companies learning to work with each other across borders. I would expect more US companies to go to China because it's much easier in the visa situation right now. So I traveled on the visa-free transit where you enter and exit through different countries. And that's super easy to do. You pretty much just show up. Whereas like a Chinese researcher or engineer traveling to the US, you have to wait for the visa games. So I expect more US medium-sized startups that are interested in open models to go to China, which is probably going to happen in the coming weeks to months. Like, this stuff happens fast. The summer of 2026.
That's good to know. You've been a frequent guest on the podcast show with Lex Friedman. He was in China recently. I think one of his videos catching a truck ride really going viral on Chinese internet. Do you and Lex actually talk privately about your China trip or his interest in visiting China?
We haven't done a postmortem of like, what do you think of China? I think both of us are just interested in seeing this large swath of humanity that influences tech that we live with so much, and seeing it firsthand, because that's the best way to understand things. And I mean, Lex has done more world traveling than I have. He's done a lot of other world traveling to begin with, so I would guess, I can't speak for him, but I would guess that it's similar in some of the motivations.
Yeah, great. And can you give us some predictions 12 months from now? What are we going to see in the China labs, and what are we going to see in the US labs?
One of the defining things I would expect is that there's going to be some sort of new agentic product that is going to be what everybody is talking about. I think Claude Code and Codex will still be around, but I think there will be others, whether it's from Google or somebody else that built a new app. Like, I think we're so early in the story of complex kind of agentic workflows across your work, so that'll be a new thing. The unpredictable things are, do the models just keep getting better as they are, or do we have a lucky breakthrough on something like continual learning? I would guess that it's more like you see the revenue of big and small AI labs alike continue to grow. OpenAI, Anthropic are public and okay.
Yeah.
But more interesting is this medium-sized companies together, Fireworks, Base 10, and also some of these Chinese labs like Kimi, ZAI, Minimax, where they sell a mix of tokens and models and aren't as giant. They're also going to be doing pretty well in terms of selling intelligence because there's just so much demand for this. I would expect the accepted gap between the frontier models in the US and China to have widened. So like if people were saying 3 months, they'll say 6 to 9 months, or they'll say a year, but it won't look like the Chinese labs have consolidated and given up. So like we will probably have a DeepSeek V5, we'll have Kimi K3, we'll have GLM 6 and all of these things. So like 12 months is still such a short timeline where we're seeing such a rapid rise in demand, where it's like, the markets are still probably going to be going crazy. Like, we haven't reacted. We haven't fully processed this demand cycle, so it'll still probably feel like a continuation of that. Where if you ask me, like, 3 to 5 years, I'd be like, one of the major Chinese labs might have gone under due to finance. Like, I don't know, like Minimax or Zhipu goes under for some financing thing, and there's more corrections in the U.S. market and stuff. Like, I think once you get to that 3 to 5 to 10 year timeline.
Cool. After this trip, are you more optimistic or more worried about the global AI race?
I think I'm pretty neutral. I think most of my worries on AI are like very centered on like US opinion being sour on AI and how that could hurt progress. I think the global AI race is roughly what I would expect geopolitically. In this biggest picture, it's like the US is ahead and the Chinese wants to catch up, and there's this nuance in terms of how much chips are being sold and what that like what that pin ends up doing to the ecosystem. I think it's mostly just a benefit to be able to bring more humanity to this and like do what I can to make it less of a very extreme circumstance for people on both sides. So people building and using the technology that have very little say on what the highest level decisions are. It's like I could do a small part to make that more understood for both sides.
All right, thanks so much, Nathan. I think all those are my questions. Anything else you want to add? Any question I didn't ask?
No, thanks for having me. I'll hopefully sometime soon go for a second trip to China. There's plenty more to see.
Yeah, we'll love to have the second interview after your next trip.
Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. Yeah, tell us about what you guys do.
So AI2 does all sorts of kind of open source AI research and development. I think it's historically been fairly academic, and over time it's been moving more into this artifact defined development where you're building models and code bases and data sets that the rest of the community can build on. So I think Olmo and these open language models has been the most popular one, but there's also like Molmo, the multimodal, Olmo Earth and other things. And then AI2 has historically been very well known for its integration with AI literature. So I think the application there has been Semantic Scholar, which is kind of seen as alternative to Google Scholar for searching the academic literature. And this team has evolved into building AI agents for science. So it's this Asta brand where they're building tools to assist people in building and understanding the scientific literature. So I think at its core, AI2's deepest culture is so scientific and like has this community value of building a lot of just like net good for the scientific community, which is really great. And that comes through in these papers that are very detail oriented and caring. And I think there's just like so many different ways, which way we want to go.
Yeah.
There's so many different ways that this comes through. And it's the best, one of the best things about working at AI2 is you just like, you get so focused on trying to build things that various researchers use when you travel as an academic, and you're like, all these people are building on Olmo and know of AI2. And it's just kind of like, a lasting thing that is great. And there's interns or student researchers, and they go out into that academic community and all these other research institutions to kind of spread this scientific value, which is a great service that AI2 does.
Yeah, how many people do you have right now?
Probably about 200 people.
Oh wow, that's a lot. So most of them are researchers, right?
I would guess probably half of the talent is technical engineering on like the traditional AI research, and then there's engineering teams that help support our clusters and some of our products.
How is like an NGO lab different from other labs in Silicon Valley?
So AI2 is a full nonprofit, which means most of its money comes from philanthropies. So the Allen is on the door, which is from Paul Allen, one of the co-founders of Microsoft, and then also has large grants from, for example, from the NSF. So it's all nonprofit funding and doesn't really sell any products. It just gives everything it makes away for free for people to learn from.
Wow. So you guys have more research freedom, I guess.
Yeah. So I think that on the spectrum of closed lab to academia in terms of resources, it sits in the middle in terms of freedom, which is like we have more resources and we feel pressure to build models that are actually good. So it like does suppress the freedom a little bit, but much less than a frontier lab that is like racing towards AGI. Yeah. But if you go to a true academic institution, you'll see that they have a diversity and kind of intellectual spark that you like won't get at a company just based on the needs of paying the bills.
How is Seattle vibe different from the Silicon Valley vibe?
It's so much calmer. Like, there's not events all the time with various people meeting up. I personally wish that more people in Seattle, like there's major tech talent hubs at Amazon, Microsoft, and all the tech companies would have more of this. But that's what it is. You can't fight it. In some ways, I think it's a better place to like settle down and have a family because it's like a bit more spread out and it's a bit less intense and how bright everything is in terms of talking about AI. Like, I don't have AI in every conversation, where in the Bay Area, AI feels like it's the only conversation right now, which I understand why. Like, I'm bought in as well.
But you visited the Bay Area a lot.
I go regularly. I say I go like 3 to 8 times a year.
Okay.
I went to UC Berkeley, so I lived in the Bay Area for like 7 or 8 years. Uh-huh. And then you have to go back to stay in touch with what's actually happening.
In the Bay Area, you don't have the view like this, a very beautiful lake. What's the name of it?
Lake Union.
Definitely my dreaming office for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you visit China, how do you think the office there, the AI lab office there?
They don't have this view, but they're also tech company offices where it's like they're pretty similar in that regards, or like I go in them and it feels like I'm in a tech company, and I've been into a lot of tech offices in my life, and it's like okay, the showroom culture is different.
Oh yeah, showroom, but that's really like unique in China.
That is a very unique China thing that a lot of people just I think have to visit for the first time, and then they're like, oh, okay, this is the thing.
cool, thank you so much Nathan for having us.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
好，那以上呢就是我与 Nathan 的对话了，以及 AI2 的 Office Tour。感谢大家的收看，你们的留言、转发还有点赞是支持我们硅谷1020要做好深度科技和商业内容的最佳动力。我是陈倩，那我们就下期视频再见啦，拜。